It's a wonderful thing for me to have a group of students, of young people playing even a piece of this early period. It's marvelous, but marvelous that such a thing can happen. When this piece was written, it was considered very modern and a little bit hard to understand, and it had very few, almost very, very, very few performances, usually by doctors' orchestras. And the only bright moment that I can remember about this performance was one in Cooper Union down in New York City by a WPA orchestra. Those were musicians who were out of work, and Franklin Roosevelt was giving them money to get together and do a symphony. They didn't play very well, some of them kept playing wrong notes. But Duke Ellington was in the audience, and he came up and shook my hand, and he said, I think you've been listening to jazz. And so I remember very vividly, and with a great deal of pleasure at that time. And let me say that this particular piece, even as I was writing it, I thought of the fact that there were around me composers like William Schumann and even Aaron Copland, who were encouraged by Koussevitzky to write these gigantic pieces with the whole orchestra making lots of noise. And so I thought I would write sort of a piece like Haydn, very small, because this is what I felt about things. I didn't think a great big bombastic thing was exactly the thing I thought about this country that I'd lived in for so long. So I wanted to write a piece that was intimate and pleasurable and amusing in some way. I can talk about it a lot more, but you want to hear more?
Oh, of course we would.
Well, the piece, I wrote it, and it worried me a good deal, because it did have one performance by the New York Philharmonic, but only by the conductor Rod Zindigi, who decided to give a concert, not a public concert, but a private concert, of contemporary American music pieces just for the composers to hear them. And I went with actually the composer Edgar Varese, who was a friend of mine, to hear this. My piece didn't make it, they played it, but Mr. Rosinski did not include it among his pieces, a few pieces he played contemporary music during the concert season. And I had this kind of rebuff. People looked at it and they said, well, you know, it's a little bit hard to understand, a little bit peculiar and so forth. So that I didn't have a very good thing. However, because of the fact that it had this difficult time, I showed it to lots of people and asked them what they thought of it. And as a matter of fact, the piece, Aaron Copland, for instance, suggested that the way I began it, it was not a good way to begin. And you will hear it, that there's a place about a minute, a half a minute in, maybe less, where the timpani play all alone. That's the way it began in the beginning. And then Aaron said, you know, you should have a nice beginning. And so I put a nice beginning. I did that. I was very concerned, as anybody would be when I was very young. You want to get your piece played. And I wanted to do things that would make it play. To the music public of that time. And I also cut out I had the last movement which had references to the first movement and the second movement, about 10 measures of slow music running in the middle of that. And Aaron said, you can't write a fast piece and have it slow up in the middle of it. So I moved them out. So there was a good little advice on the part of him and other people that I began to change the piece. I don't know whether I think it was a good idea up now.
You have talked to me many very interesting things about how different it was for American composers when you were just starting out.
Well, let me say that the problem about American composers at the time that I was starting out, which was in the 1920s, in the late 1920s, was that the American composers pretty much entirely, so they had to pay to get their music played, and were not paid for it. They always had to raise money to get and then pay the orchestra to play. Even on the part of very well-known composers like Edward McDowell and others, and a number of us formed what was like a union. And forbade American music to be played by any orchestra for 2 years, and we finally went out and got. And now we get paid some, not so much, but some, for performances. In fact, since my music is largely played in Europe, I have an income that I could live on perfectly well without moving a finger.
I think you move fingers quite a bit while you're writing music.
Yes.
Now, your music, of course, through the years has changed a lot. But even when you listen to this early symphony, there are elements which you find in your latest works as well.
You know that better than I do.
Well, I mean, what impresses me, first of all, is the fantastically worked out counterpoint, which is always unexpected, but fits in a way which you can't conceive somehow would actually be different.
Yeah, well, of course, when I was studying in Boston, I met him right at Harvard. I find the music department so stuffy, I finally studied English and didn't study music at all. But I went to Paris and studied with Nadia Boulanger, as many different ways, Aaron Copland and Roy Harris and many other people at that time. And at that, I went from counterpoint, from 2 to 8 parts. And I got to be pretty good at writing 8-part counterpoint, which is even worse than a crossword puzzle.
Another thing which I noticed from this, from the early piece, is how you have many unexpected moments, so that there are phrase lengths which we think will be one length but are another length, and also it's almost in this piece as if you have these kind of polymetric or polyrhythmic larger forms when going on, when you have the cellos and basses playing in one rhythm and another group playing in another rhythm. It's all worked out in a more classical way, we can say, than your recent works. But it still is present.
Yeah, I think also the thing that is like the recent works is noticeable here. It makes this, as a matter of fact, although it has many harmonic things that sound like Aaron Copland, I wrote long lines in this piece, which Aaron Copland never did. So that they, as you will hear, that slow movement goes on and on and on, maybe 2 months. It's a long, big, long, slow movement for good, pretty almost from beginning to end.
That's right, yeah. It's quite remarkable.
A melodic line, which has persisted throughout a lot of my music in recent years.
So, I'm wondering if we could perhaps take a couple of questions from the audience.
Well, if anybody can ask a question and I can understand how
speak to you, and then we will go on. Yeah, perhaps. Does anyone have a question you would like to ask? Yes, please. Did you write the movements in the order that they are in? In other words, begin with the first, or do you begin in another place and find out later?
I wrote what's the last movement now. What would be a dance in a ballet that I've written before that called Pocahontas. And I decided when I started, was encouraged to write Pocahontas and began to have a real a performance with the Ballet Caravan in New York. I eliminated this and broke music to perhaps, I hope, a little more suitable to an Indian situation.
I see. Yeah. Any other question? Maybe one more. Yes.
After all these years, can you tell if piece is going to be successful? And do you compose for the mark for the audience, or do you compose for yourself?
He was basically wondering, after all these years, can you tell if a piece will be successful, and do you write for your audience, or do you write for yourself?
My answer to that is I come from an old school. You see, to have written even this piece, I was not writing for an audience. I was hoping that it would be played, but I wrote for what I thought was what I wanted to write. I had written a ballet, Pocahontas, before this. It was a good deal more dissonant and more unusual in many ways. And it was got a performance, and it got a couple of performances by the Ballet Caravan, actually in the Martin Beck Theater in New York. And I had two thoughts about this. One is that if one is a trained musician and has gone through all that harmony and counterpoint and history of music, that you already know what an imaginary audience expects. I have gone, well, at the beginning I became interested in being composed by hearing the Rite of Spring and hating older music, but gradually I began to see that there was something in Beethoven that I began to respect and love, including Bach and all the rest of them. So I felt that I should write the music that I think is important because it's a result of all this connection with all the history of music and with the various techniques that older composers have used. And also the desire not to do them exactly that way, or maybe to do them a different way, or do something utterly different. But it was all with the knowledge that I had studied the musical world, or music that I loved and thought was worth bothering about, was sort of the standard that I tried to achieve. I think as far as the idea of writing for someone else, I think that I really write for performers as well. And I think I've written pieces for Charlie, for instance, with him in mind. And I've written a good many pieces with the idea that I was going to have a particular, either a particular person play them or a particular orchestra. And I've always felt that if the performer likes the music enough, the public will like it too.
Yeah, I think that's a very important statement. Yes. So I think with this, perhaps we will move on to the rest of the program.
Which is what?
First, I will actually play two of your clarinet pieces. I will play Steep Steps and then Grom. And then we will move on to the symphony.
Okay, well, am I going to move on to the seat?
I guess so.